Some 25 years ago, well before I became a priest, I served on the vestry of a small church back in Arkansas where one day the priest decided to change from using the traditional Lord's Prayer in the services on Sunday, you know, Our Father who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name, to the contemporary version that we use here most often, Our Father in heaven, hallowed be your name, and so forth. And 2 or 3 weeks after the change, an elderly woman in the parish who was something of a conservative, a traditionalist, she approached me after the service, and inquired, why was this change made? I told her she should go ask the priest that question, since he was the one who made that decision. But she seemed unconvinced and wanted to bend my ear instead. She launched into a distressed cry and said she just wanted to say the actual words that Jesus said, Our Father who art in heaven. Mrs. Smith, I don't think Jesus knew Elizabethan English. It was not a helpful retort on my part. Even if it is an instructive story for us all as a community of faith. Most scholars agree today that when Jesus tells us in this gospel passage, tells the disciples to pray this way, he wasn't saying use those exact words, but the phrases he offers are meant to be guides, a roadmap of sorts into the relationship with a God who is earnestly listening, always listening, and if we will listen, then maybe a God who will respond as well. Prayer is an invitation into dialogue with the God whose reign of peace we long for, who provides our needs, who calls us into particular ways of living that involve forgiveness and resisting evil and being mindful of the needs of others. This is why the Lord's Prayer is such a fine template for us and why we use it week by week and day by day in our prayerful life, even if it risks becoming rote, because it is a guide for us as we strive to embrace this way of life that's grounded in the relational identity as people of God. But I will tell you, much more intriguing than that passage in the gospel this morning for me this week has been this curious passage from the book of Genesis that we heard read a few moments ago. You know, the one where Abraham is seemingly bargaining with God to consider sparing the righteous ones who may be caught up in the city of Sodom. 50, Lord, would that work? 45, 40, 30, 20, 10. How many, O Lord, must there be for you to consider sparing them? It's an odd story, isn't it? Fascinating one, too. I'll tell you, it wouldn't let me go this week. So this is where I want to focus this morning. I'll tell you now that this is something of a technical sermon to lift the stories out of ancient history and perhaps into an application in our lives here and now. And with that in mind, I have three themes that I want to trace from this passage. First, the destruction of Sodom is not about homosexuality, no matter how prevalent that is understood to be. It just isn't. Secondly, the bargaining between Abraham and Yahweh is a remarkable portal for us to understand the nature of prayer and through it to understand the nature of God in a way radically different than those who predate Abraham would have been. In fact, it is so much an important part of our identity even today that this is our story, folks, and we are called to wrestle with it. So this passage is a portal for us. And then thirdly, I would present to you the possibility that God is open to redirection, as odd as that may sound. So have I piqued your interest at all? Shall we dive in? We need to set the scene first. This passage we heard this morning is the second of three acts that go together as part of a saga that unfolds across chapters 18 and 19 of Genesis. Read the full story if you dare, but know that if you do, It must not be taken literally. You will fail to see the truth in it if you do. It requires interpretation, as all of our scriptures do. And to be sure, there are problematic parts in this saga. But here's the important part, is all of it is stipulated upon the intimate relationship that Abraham and Yahweh share because of the covenant that they gathered together and made together, as recorded back in chapter 12 of Genesis. In fact, that's where you really ought to start if you want to read it. Go back to 12 and then read on through, because in 12 we hear that Abraham is blessed so that he might be a blessing for all the families of the earth. It's a vocation. And folks, we are descendants of Abraham sitting here this morning. Now, we heard the first act of this three-part story last week when three strangers visited Abraham and Sarah and told them that Sarah is going to have a son despite her long having since gone through menopause. She laughs at the thought. But the author of Genesis tips their hand and lets us know that these visitors are actually two angels and Yahweh, who is the source of this miracle, which will have global implications, effectuated all by a birth to a really old couple. And then if we jump over to chapter 19, the third act is where the two angels end up in Sodom. They're sent there by Yahweh to determine whether the prayerful pleas that Yahweh is hearing out of the people suffering in Sodom are substantiated. And if so, are they sufficient to prompt God to rain down fire upon the city in judgment for its wickedness? Now, you need to know, we don't get chapter 19 and the destruction of Sodom anywhere in our lectionary. You won't get it on a Sunday morning. You have to go read it yourself, offline if you want. It's disturbing. But there is some truth underneath it, because it is an ancient myth. Scholars think that the story of Sodom is really much older material than what is in Genesis, several centuries older, evolving from an ancient Near East myth about the collapse of an ancient village in the region, perhaps destroyed by a volcano or earthquake. They were both common in that area, but they were interpreted as being caused, the destruction being caused by the gods as punishment for the city's corrupt ways, because that's how the gods had always behaved throughout history. Rewards for being good, punishment for being bad. It's a theology of moralism upon which many of us were even raised here in modernity, right? You better watch out, you better not shout. Who's been naughty or nice? It's the same. Rewards for being good, punishment for being bad. It's not our theology. But more specifically, many of us have been taught that the sin of Sodom warranting destruction was that of homosexuality. But it is just simply not the case, folks. That perversion of the text, Genesis 19, developed many centuries later, in the 11th century, in fact, in the Middle Ages, and eventually found its way into modern Christian fundamentalism, where many of us picked up some of that misguidance, that misinterpretation that it's dependent upon their homosexuality as the need for the destruction, comes out of one proof text of Genesis 19:5, which describes a mob of Sodom's men going to the door of the man who invited the two angels, the two men, in as hospitality for strangers. And the mob is saying, "Send them out so that we may know them." Know them, not the word used in the Bible for homosexuality or homosexual acts, but know them, the violence of a mob saying, "We will not tolerate strangers in this place. Send them out so that we may know them and kill them." That's the problem here. The verb for homosexual actions is not in this passage, folks. It's about violence to the stranger. Now, Sodom is referenced several other places in the Bible as an example of society, an example, think mythic, example of society run amok with pride and arrogance and gluttony and reckless disregard for those in need and reckless disregard for the stranger. The indictment on Sodom is in its corrupted and disordered society that has turned against the ways we are called to treat one another. Folks, can you hear the echo of that indictment down into our own day, in our own nation, in our own society, in our own village? And if we are on that trajectory that might spell destruction for civilization as we know it, hatred, xenophobia, climate change, if we are on that trajectory, folks, if such forces of arrogance and neglect continue to erode the fabric of societal well-being, what are we as people of God to do about it? That's what this story is about. Which brings me back to the second act, the one we heard this morning, with Abraham engaging Yahweh in his serial petitions, asking humbly, what would it take for the city to be spared for the sake of the righteous? Now, some scholars believe this isn't bargaining at all. It's actually a brilliant theological innovation that allows us to glimpse in a transition point in understanding who God is, in a glimpse into the prayerful life of one so intimately engaged with the relationship with God that he can ask any question in that relationship, and it's fair game. He can trust God so fully that no question is off limits when it arises from the heart of one longing to make sense of his world or to ease the pain of her world. And this is the invitation for us, all of us in our prayer lives, folks, to embrace the relationship with God so fully that an abiding trust creates the space for us to ask any question. Any request can be made, and that nothing is beyond the scope of possibility with this God of ours. My friends, our scriptures are replete with this pattern of prayer, grounded in the consummate trust that God can handle anything, whatever it is that we bring to the relationship, God can handle it. And Jesus says, when you pray, pray this way. Be all in with the relationship. And if you do, it will change your life. If you do, it will change the world. Who knows? Maybe even God might change. Now, I know that sounds crazy to the traditionalist's ear, even heretical perhaps. But here's the truth, folks. The Bible has several accounts of God changing God's mind. We need look no further than Noah, or the book of Isaiah, or the prophet Jeremiah, or Job, or the prophet Hosea, or even the Gospels, in which God gives up the old ways of scorekeeping that every disease, every affliction, every shortcoming is seen as a consequence of sin, and says, "Fooey on that." I was thinking of another word, but I caught myself. God says no to that. Bring what you have on your heart. Be all in. The scare theology of moralism was long ago replaced by a God of steadfast love and mercy, still exacting judgment when we refuse to turn away from the evil, but always longing for the chance for God to be redirected whenever we open the relationship to that possibility. And that conversion of God, friends, can be traced exactly back to this Genesis chapter 18. and this engagement between Abraham and God, in which Abraham pleads with God to be different than all those other gods that had gone before, to be the God of the covenant that Abraham knew God to be the God of consummate justice when dealing in human history, to be gracious and merciful, not because the guilty necessarily deserve it, but simply because Yahweh is that kind of God. And only because God is that kind of God can we even begin to make our prayer, "Forgive us our sins as we forgive those who are indebted to us." It's about relationship. It's about being born into the covenant with a two old couple who were willing to share God's dream for them and for the world, even for us here today, and live along that promise of blessing for all the families of the earth. So, daughters and sons of Abraham, we have work to do. We have work to do. And we make our prayer, "Bless us, O God, that we may be a blessing to all the families of the earth." Amen.